Chapter 3. At the close of the war, General William Tecumseh Sherman was placed at the head of the Peace Commission, which had been sent to the border to take counsel with the Indians. It had become necessary to put an end to the hostility of the red man immediately, either by treaty or by force. His raids on the settlers could be endured no longer. The purpose of the party which Sherman headed was to confer with the greatest of the hostile chiefs. Treaties were to be agreed upon if possible. If negotiations for peace failed, the council would at least act as a stay of hostilities. The army was rapidly reorganizing, and it would soon be possible to mobilize enough troops to put down the Indians in case they refused to come to terms peaceably. The camp of the Kiowas and Comanches, the first Indians with whom Sherman meant to deal, was about 300 miles southwest of Leavenworth, in the Great Buffalo Range, and in the midst of the trackless plains. By ambulance and on horseback, with wagons to carry the supplies, the party set out for its first objective, Council Springs on the Arkansas River, about 60 miles beyond Old Fort Zra. I was chosen as one of the scouts or dispatch carriers to accompany the party. The guide was Dick Curtis, a plainsman of wide experience among the Indians. When we arrived at Fort Zra, we found that no road lay beyond, and learned that there was no water on the way. It was determined, therefore, to make a start at 2 o'clock in the morning. Curtis said this would enable us to reach our destination, 65 miles further on, by 2 o'clock the next afternoon. The outfit consisted of 2 ambulances and 1 government wagon, which carried the tents and supplies. Each officer had a horse to ride if he chose. If he preferred to ride in the ambulance, his orderly was on hand to lead his horse for him. We traveled steadily till 10 o'clock in the morning, through herds of buffalo, whose numbers were past counting. I remember that General Sherman estimated that the number of buffalo on the plains at the time must have been more than 11 million. It required all the energy of the soldiers and scouts to keep a road cleared through the herd so that the ambulance might pass. We breakfasted during the morning stop and rested the horses. For the men there was plenty of water, which we had brought along in canteens and camp kettles. There was also a little for the animals, enough to keep them from suffering on the way. 2 o'clock found us still making our way through the buffalo herds, but with no Council Springs in sight. Curtis was on ahead, and one of the lieutenants, feeling a little nervous, rode up to another of the scouts. "How far are we from the springs?" he inquired. "I don't know," said the guide uneasily. "I never was over here before, but if anyone knows where the springs are, that young fellow over there does." He pointed to me. "When will we get to the springs?" asked the officer, turning in my direction. "Never, if we keep on going the way we are now," I said. "Why don't you tell the general that?" he demanded. I said that Curtis was the guide, not I, whereupon he dropped back alongside the ambulance, in which Sherman was riding, and reported what had happened. The general instantly called a halt and sent for the scouts. When all of us, including Curtis, had gathered round him, he got out of the ambulance, and, pulling out a map, directed Curtis to locate the springs on it. "There has never been a survey made of this country, General," said Curtis. "None of these maps are correct." "I know that myself," said Sherman. "How far are we from the springs?" The guide hesitated. "I have never been there but once," he said, "and then I was with a big party of Indians who did the guiding." He added that on a perfectly flat country, dotted with buffalo, he could not positively locate our destination. Unless we were sighted and guided by Indians, we would have to chance it. Sherman swung round on the rest of us. "Do any of you know where the springs are?" he asked, looking directly at me.
"Yes, sir," I said, "I do."
"How do you know, Billy?" asked Curtis.
"I used to come over here with Charlie Bath, the Indian trader," I said.
"Where are we now?" asked Sherman. "About 12 miles from the springs."
"They are due south."
"Due south? And we are traveling due west?"
"Yes, sir," I replied, "but if Mr. Curtis had not turned in a few minutes, I was going to tell you." So for 12 miles I rode with Sherman, and we became fast friends. He asked me all manner of questions on the way, and I found that he knew my father well, and remembered his tragic death in Salt Creek Valley. He asked what had become of the rest of the family and all about my career. By the end of the ride I had told him my life history. As we were riding along together, with the outfit following on, I noticed bony tracks from time to time, and knew that we were nearing the springs. Presently I said, "General, we are going to find Indians at the springs when we reach there." "How do you know?" "We have been riding, where ponies have been grazing for the last mile." "I haven't seen any tracks," said the general in surprise. "Show me one." I jumped off my horse, and, thrusting the buffalo grass aside, I pointed out many tracks of barefooted ponies. "When we rise that ridge," I told him, "we shall see the village, and thousands of ponies and Indian lodges." In a very few minutes this prophecy came true. Curtis and the other scouts with the officers rode up quickly behind us, and we all had a fine view of this wonderful sight of the desert, a great Indian camp. As we stood gazing at the spectacle, we observed great excitement in the village. Warriors by the dozens were leaping on their horses and riding toward us, till at least 1,000 of them were in the receiving line. "It looks to me as if we had better fall into position," said Sherman. "It is not necessary," I said. "They have given us the peace sign. They are coming toward us without arms." So Sherman, with General Harney, General Sanborn, and the other officers rode slowly forward to meet the oncoming braves. "This is where you need Curtis," I told the general as he advanced. "He's the best Kiowa and Comanche interpreter on the plains and he knows every one of these Indians personally." Curtis was accordingly summoned and made interpreter, while I was assigned to remain about the commander's tent and given charge of the scouts. As the Indians drew near with signs of friendliness, Curtis introduced the chiefs, Sabinta, Lone Wolf, Kicking Bird, and others to General Sherman, as the head of the Peace Commission. The Indians, having been notified in advance of the coming of the commission, had already selected a special spring for our camp, and had prepared a great feast in honor of the meeting. To this feast, which was spread in the center of the village, the commissioners were conducted, while the scouts and the escort went into camp. The Indians had erected a great canopy of tan buffalo skins on teepee poles. Underneath were robes for seats for the general and his staff, and thither they were led with great ceremony. Nearby was a great fire on which buffalo, antelope, and other animals were roasting. Even coffee and sugar had been provided, and the feast was served with tin plates for the meat and tin cups for the coffee. Another tribute to the customs of the guests was a complete outfit of knives and forks. Napkins, however, appeared to be lacking. Indian girls, dressed in elaborate costumes, served the repast, the elder women preparing the food. Looking on, it seemed to me to be the most beautiful sight I had ever seen, the grim old generals, who for the last 4.5 years had been fighting a great war, sitting serenely and contentedly down to meet and drink with the chiefs of a wild, and, till lately, a hostile race. After all had eaten, their great chief, Sabinta, loaded a big peace pipe, whose bowl was hewn from red stone, with a beautifully carved stem 18 inches long. The pipe was passed from mouth to mouth around the circle. After the smoke was ended, Sabinta raised his towering bulk above the banqueters. He drew his red blanket around his broad shoulders, leaving his naked right arm free, for without his right arm an Indian is deprived of his real powers of oratory. Making signs to illustrate his every sentence, he spoke, "My great white brothers, I welcome you to my camp and to my people. You can rest in safety, without a thought of fear, because our hearts are now good to you, because we hope that the words you are going to speak to us will make us glad that you have come. We know that you have come a long way to see us. We feel that you are going to give us or send us presents, which will gladden the hearts of all my people. I know that you must be very tired, and as I see that your tents are pitched, it would make our hearts glad to walk over to your village with you, where you can rest and sleep well, and we hope that you will dream of the many good things are going to send us, and tell us when you rested. I have sent to your tents the choicest of young buffalo, deer, and antelope, and if there is anything else in my camp, which will make your hearts glad, I will be pleased to send it to you. If any of your horses should stray away, my young men will bring them back to you." As the old chief concluded, General Sherman, rising, shook his hand and said, "My red brother, your beautiful and romantic reception has deeply touched the hearts of my friends and myself. We most heartily thank you for it. When we are rested, and after we have slept in your wild prairie city, we should like to hold a council with the chiefs and warriors congregated here." When the officers returned to their own camp, they agreed that the feast was very grand, that the Indian maidens who served it were very pretty in their gay costumes and beautiful moccasins. Most of them, however, had observed that the hands of the squaws who did the cooking looked as if they had not touched water for several months. It stuck in the memory of some of the guests that, in their efforts to clean the tinware, the squaws had left more soap in the corners than was necessary. The coffee had a strong flavor of soap. "If we are going to have a banquet every day," said one officer, "I think I'll do my eating in our own camp." Illustration: Chief Satan to pass the peace pipe to General Sherman and said, "My great white brothers." General Sherman reminded him that this would be highly impolite to the hosts, and ordered them, as soldiers, to make the best of the entertainment and to line up for mess when the Indians made a feast. At 10 o'clock the next morning the first session of the Great Council was held. For 3 days the white chiefs and the red chiefs sat in a circle under the canopy, and many promises of friendship were made by the Indians. When the council was concluded, General Sherman sent for me. "Billy," he said, "I want you to send 2 good men to Fort Ellsworth with dispatches, where they can be forwarded to Fort Riley, the end of the telegraph line. After your men are rested they can return to Fort Zara and join us." When the 2 men were instructed by the general and were on their way, he took me into his tent. "I want to go to Bent's Fort on the Arkansas River," he said, "then to Fort St. Bernard, on the Platte, and then to Laramie. After that we will go to Cottonwood Springs, then to Fort Kearney and then to Leavenworth. Can you guide me on the trip?" I told him that I could, and was made guide, chief of scouts, and master of transportation, acting with an army officer as quartermaster. At Bent's Fort another council of 2 days was held with the Indians. The journey homeward was made without difficulty. At Leavenworth I took leave of one of the noblest and kindest-hearted men I have ever known. In bidding me goodbye, General Sherman said, "I don't think these councils we have held will amount to much. There was no sincerity in the Indians' promises. I will see that the promises we made to them are carried out to the letter, but when the grass grows in the spring they will be, as usual, on the warpath. As soon as the regular army is organized it will have to be sent out here on the border, to quell fresh Indian uprisings, because these Indians will give us no peace till they are thoroughly thrashed." The general thanked me for my services, and told me he was very lucky to find me. "It is not possible that I will be with the troops when they come," he said. "They will be commanded by General Philip Sheridan. You will like Sheridan. He is your kind of a man. I will tell him about you when I see him. I expect to hear great reports of you when you are guiding the United States Army over the plains, as you have so faithfully guided me. The quartermaster has instructions to pay you at the rate of $150 a month, and as a special reward I have ordered that you be paid $2,000 extra. Goodbye. I know you will have good luck, for you know your business." After the departure of General Sherman I made a brief visit to my sisters in Salt Creek Valley, and for a time, there being no scouting work to do, drove stage between Plum Creek and Fort Kearney. I was still corresponding with Miss Fredericksy, the girl I had left behind me in St. Louis. My future seemed now secure, so I decided that it was high time I married and settled down, if a scout can ever settle down. So, surrendering my stage job, I returned to Leavenworth and embarked for St. Louis by boat. After a week's visit at the home of my fiancée we were quietly married at her home. I made, I suppose, rather a wild-looking groom. My brown hair hung down over my shoulders, and I had just started a little mustache and goatee. I was dressed in the Western fashion, and my appearance was, to say the least, unusual. We were married at 11 o'clock in the morning, and took a steamer morning star at 2 in the afternoon for our honeymoon journey home. As we left our carriages and entered the steamer, my wife's father and mother and a number of friends accompanying us, I noticed that I was attracting considerable excited attention. A number of people, men and women, were on the deck. As we passed, I heard them whispering, "There he is. That's him. I'd know him in the dark." It was very plain to me that these observations were not particularly friendly. The glares cast at me were openly hostile. While we were disposing our baggage in our stateroom, I had hired the bridal chamber, I heard some of my wife's friends asking her father if he knew who I was, and whether I had any credentials. He replied that he had left the matter of credentials to his daughter. "Well," said one of the party, "these people on board are excursionists from Independence, and they say the son-in-law of yours is the most desperate outlaw, bandit, and house burner on the frontier." The old gentleman was considerably disturbed at this report. He made up his mind to get a little first-hand information, and he took the most direct means of getting it. "Who are you?" he asked, walking over to me. "The people on board don't give you a very good recommendation." "Kindly remember," I replied, "that we have had a little war for the past 5 years on the border. These people were on one side and I on the other, and it is natural that they shouldn't think very highly of me." My argument was not convincing. "I'm going to take my daughter home again," said my father-in-law, and started toward the stateroom. I besought him to leave the decision to her, and for the next 10 minutes I pleaded my case with all the eloquence I could command. I was talking against odds, for my wife, as well as her parents' friends, were all ardent Southerners, and I am proud to say that after 50 years of married life, she is still as strongly Sish as ever. But when I put the case to her, she said gamely that she had taken me for better or for worse and intended to stick to me. She was in tears when she said goodbye to her parents and friends, and still in tears after they had left. I tried to comfort her with assurances that when we came among northern people I would not be regarded as such a desperate character, but my consolation was of little avail. At dinner the hostile stares that were bent on me from our neighbors at table did not serve to reassure her. It was some comfort to me afterward when the captain sent for me and told me that he knew me, that my uncle Elijah was his old-time friend and one of the most extensive shippers on the steamboat line. "It is shameful the way these people are treating you," he said, "but let it pass, and when we get to Independence everything will be all right." But everything was not all right. In the evening, when I led my wife out on the floor of the cabin, where the passengers were dancing, every dancer immediately walked off the floor, the men scowling and the women with their noses in the air. All that night my wife wept while I walked the floor. At daybreak, when we stopped for wood, I heard shots and shouting. Walking out on deck, I saw the freed Negroes, who composed the crew, scrambling back on board. The steamboat was backing out in the stream. Later I learned that my fellow passengers had wired up the river, that I was on board, and an armed party had ridden down to get me. I quickly returned to the stateroom, and, diving into my trunk, took out and buckled on a brace of revolvers, which had done excellent service in times past. This action promptly confirmed my wife's suspicions. She was now certain that I was the bandit I had been accused of being. I had no time to reason with her now. Throwing my coat back, so that I rested my hands on the butts of my revolvers, I strolled out through the crowd. One or two men who had been doing a great deal of loud talking a few minutes past backed away, as I walked past and looked them squarely in the eyes. Nothing more was said, and soon I reached the steward's office, unmolested. Here I found a number of men dressed in blue uniforms. They told me they were discharged members of the 8th Indiana Volunteers. They were traveling to Kansas, steerage, saving their money so they might have it to invest in homes when they reached their destination. They had all heard of me, and now proposed to arm and defend me should there be any further hostile demonstrations. I gladly welcomed their support, more for my wife's sake than for my own. "My wife," I said, "firmly believes that I am an outlaw." "You can't blame her," said the spokesman of the party, "after what has happened. But wait till she gets among Union people and she will learn her mistake. We know your history, and of your recent services to General Sherman. We know that old Pap Sherman wouldn't have an outlaw in his service. If you had seen some of the interviews he has given out about your wife's father and his friends, there would have been trouble at the start. My newfound friends did not do things by halves. In order to be able to give a ball in the cabin, they exchanged their steerage tickets for first-class passage. That night the ball was given, with my wife and myself as the guests of honor. The Independence crowd, observing the preparations for the ball, demanded that the captain stop at the first town and let them off. They saw that the tide had turned, and were apprehensive of reprisals. The captain told them that if they should behave like ladies and gentlemen, all would be well. That night they stood outside looking in while my wife, now quite reassured, was introduced to the ladies and gentlemen from Indiana, and danced till she was weary. We looked for trouble when we reached Independence the next day. There was a bigger crowd than usual on the levee, but when it was seen that my Yankee friends had their Spencer carbines with them, all was quiet. As we pulled out, the old captain called me outside. "Cody, it is all over now," he said. "But don't you think you were the only restless man on board? When I backed out into the river the other night, I had to leave four of my best deckhands either dead or wounded on the bank. I will never forget the way you walked out through the crowd with that pair of guns in your hand. I have heard of the execution these weapons can do when they get in action. When we stopped at Kansas City, I telegraphed to Leavenworth that we were coming. As the boat approached the Leavenworth levee, my soldier friends were out on deck in their dress uniforms, and I stood on the deck, my bride on my arm. Soon we heard the music of the Fort Leavenworth band and the town band, and crowds of citizens were on the wharf, as the boat tied up. The commandant of the fort, Dr. Anthony, the mayor of Leavenworth, my sisters, and hundreds of my friends came rushing aboard the boat to greet us. That night we were given a big banquet, to which my soldier chums and their wives were invited. My wife had a glorious time. After it was all over, she put her arms about my neck and cried, "Willie, I don't believe you are an outlaw at all." I had reluctantly promised my wife that I would abandon the plains. It was necessary to make a living, so I rented a hotel in Salt Creek Valley, the same hotel my mother had formerly conducted, and set up as a landlord. It was a typical frontier hotel, patronized by people going to and from the plains, and it took considerable tact and diplomacy to conduct it successfully. I called the place their Golden Rule House, and tried to conduct it on that principle. I seemed to have the qualifications necessary, but for a man who had lived my kind of life, it proved a tame employment. I found myself sighing once more for the freedom of the plains. Incidentally, I felt sure I could make money as a plainsman, and, now that I had a wife to support, money had become a very important consideration. I sold out the Golden Rule House and set out alone for Saline, Kansas, which was then at the end of construction of the Kansas Pacific Railway. On my way I stopped at Junction City, where I again met my old friend, Wild Bill, who was scouting for the government, with headquarters at Fort Ellsworth, afterward called Fort Harker. He told me more scouts were needed at the post, and I accompanied him to the fort, where I had no difficulty in securing employment. During the winter of 1866-67 I scouted between Fort Ellsworth and Fort Fletcher. I was at Fort Fletcher in the spring of 1867, when General Custer came out to accompany General Hancock on an Indian expedition. I remained here till the post was flooded by a great rise of Big Creek, on which it was located. The water overflowed the fortifications, rendering the place unfit for further occupancy, and it was abandoned by the government. The troops were removed to Fort Hays, a new post, located farther west, on the South Fork of Big Creek. It was while I was at Fort Hays that I had my first ride with the dashing Custer. He had come up from Ellsworth with an escort of only 10 men, and wanted a guide to pilot him to Fort Larned, 65 miles distant. When Custer learned that I was at the post, he asked that I be assigned to duty with him. I reported to him at daylight the next day, none too early, as Custer, with his staff and orderlies, was already in the saddle. When I was introduced to Custer, he glanced disapprovingly at the mule I was riding. "I am glad to meet you, Cody," he said. "General Sherman has told me about you. but I am in a hurry, and I am sorry to see you riding that mule. General, I returned, that is one of the best horses at the fort.
It isn't a horse at all, he said, but if it's the best you've got, we shall have to start.
We rode side by side, as we left the fort. My mule had a fast walk, which kept the general's horse most of the time in a half trot. His animal was a fine Kentucky thoroughbred, but for the kind of work at hand I had full confidence in my mount. Whenever Custer was not looking I slyly spurred the mule ahead, and when he would start forward I would rein him in and pat him by way of restraint, bidding him not to be too fractious, as we hadn't yet reached the sandals. In this way I set a good lively pace, something like 9 miles an hour, all morning. At Smoky Hill River we rested our animals. Then the general, who was impatient to be off, ordered a fresh start. I told him we had still 40 miles of sandhills to cross, and advised an easier gait. I have no time to waste on the road, he said. I want to push right ahead. Push right ahead we did. I continued quietly spurring my mule, and then counseling the brute to take it easy. Presently I noticed that the escort was stringing out far behind, as their horses became winded with the hard pace through the sand. Custer, looking back, noticed the same thing. I think we are setting too fast a pace for them, Cody, he said, but when I replied that I thought this was merely the usual pace for my mule, and that I supposed he was in a hurry, he made no further comment. Several times during the next 40 miles we had to stop to wait for the escort to close up. Their horses, sweating and panting, had reached almost the limit of their endurance. I continued patting my animal and ordering him to quiet down, and Custer at length said, "You seem to be putting it over me a little today." When we reached the high ridge overlooking Pawnee Fork we again waited for our lagging escort. As we waited I said, "If you want to send a dispatch to the officer in command at Fort Larned, I will be pleased to take it down for you. You can follow this ridge till you come to the creek, and then follow the valley right down to the fort." Custer swung around to the captain, who had just ridden up, and repeated to him my instructions as to how to reach the fort. "I shall ride ahead with Cody," he added. "Now, Cody, I am ready for you and that mouse-colored mule." The pace I set for General Custer from that time forward was some going. When we rode up to the quarters of Captain Dangerfield Parker, commandant of the post, General Custer dismounted, and his horse was led off to the stables by an orderly, while I went to the scouts' quarters. I was personally sure that my mule was well cared for, and he was fresh as a daisy the next morning. After an early breakfast I groomed and saddled my mule, and, riding down to the general's quarters, waited for him to appear. I saluted as he came out, and said that if he had any further orders I was ready to carry them out. "I am not feeling very pleasant this morning, Cody," he said. "My horse died during the night." I said I was very sorry his animal got into too fast a class the day before. "Well," he replied, "hereafter I will have nothing to say against a mule. We will meet again on the plains. I shall try to have you detailed as my guide, and then we will have time to talk over that race." A few days after my return to Fort Hays the Indians made a raid on the Kansas Pacific Railroad, killing 5 or 6 men and running off 100 or more horses and mules. The news was brought to the commanding officer, who immediately ordered Major Arms, of the 10th Cavalry, to go in pursuit of the raiders. The 10th Cavalry was a Negro regiment. Arms took a company, with one mountain howitzer, and I was sent along as scout. On the second day out we discovered a large party of Indians on the opposite side of the Saline River, and about a mile distant. The party was charging down on us and there was no time to lose. Arms placed his howitzer on a little knoll, limbered it up, and left 20 men to guard it. Then, with the rest of the command, he crossed the river to meet the Redskins. Just as he had got his men across the stream we heard a terrific shouting. Looking back toward the knoll where the gun had been left, we saw our Negro gun guard flying toward us, pursued by more than 100 Indians. More Indians were dancing about the gun, although they had not the slightest notion what to do with it. Arms turned back with his command, and drove the Redskins from their useless prize. The men dismounted and took up a position there. A very lively fight followed. 5 or 6 men, including Major Arms, were wounded, and a number of the horses were shot. As the fight proceeded, the enemy seemed to become steadily more numerous. It was apparent that reinforcements were arriving from some large party in the rear. The Negro troops, who had been boasting of what they would do to the Indians, were now singing a different tune. "We'll just blow em off the farm," they had said, before there was an enemy in sight. Now, every time the foe would charge us, some of the darkies would cry, "A day come. The whole country is alive wife em. There must be 10,000 of dem. Massa Bill, does you all reckon we is ever gwine to get out oh huh?" The major, who had been lying under the cannon since receiving his wound, asked me if I thought there was a chance to get back to the fort. I replied that there was, and orders were given for a retreat, the cannon being left behind. During the movement, a number of our men were killed by the deadly fire of the Indians. But night fell, and in the darkness we made fairly good headway, arriving at Fort Hays just at daybreak. During our absence, cholera had broken out at the post. 5 or 6 men were dying daily. For the men there was a choice of dangers, going out to fight the Indians on the prairie, or remaining in camp to be stricken with cholera. To most of us the former was decidedly the more inviting. The rise and fall of modern Rome was the chapter of frontier history in which I next figured. For a time I was part owner of a town, and on my way to fortune. And then one of those quick changes that mark Western history in the making occurred and I was left, but I will tell you the story. At the town of Ellsworth, which I visited one day while carrying dispatches to Fort Harker, I met William Rose, who had a contract for trading on the right-of-way of the Kansas Pacific near Fort Hays. His stock had been stolen by the Indians, and he had come to Ellsworth to buy more. Rose was enthusiastic about a project for laying out a town site on the west side of Big Creek, a mile from the ford, where the railroad was to cross. When, in response to a request for my opinion, I told him I thought the scheme a big one, he invited me to come in as a partner. He suggested that after the town was laid out and open to the public, we establish a store and saloon. I thought it would be a grand thing to become half owner of a town, and at once accepted the proposition. We hired a railroad engineer to survey the town site and stake it into lots. Also, we ordered a big stock of the goods usually kept in the general merchandise store on the frontier. This done, we gave the town the ancient and historical name of Rome. As a starter, we donated lots to anyone who would build on them, reserving for ourselves the corner lots and others which were best located. These reserved lots we valued at $250 each. When the town was laid out, I wrote my wife that I was worth $250,000, and told her I wanted her to get ready to come to Ellsworth by rail. She was then visiting her parents at St. Louis, with our baby daughter, whom we had named Arda. I was at Ellsworth to meet her when she arrived, bringing the baby. Besides 3 or 4 wagons, in which the supplies for the new general store and furniture for the little house I had built were loaded, I had a carriage for her and the baby. The new town of Rome was 100 miles west. I knew that it would be a dangerous trip, as the Indians had long been troublesome along the railroad, and I realized the danger more fully because of the presence of my wife and little daughter. A number of immigrants bound for the new town accompanied us. The first night out I formed the men into a company, one squad to stand watch while the others slept. All the early part of the evening I went the rounds of the camp, much to my wife's annoyance. "Why are you away so much?" she kept asking. "It is lonesome here, and I need you." Rather than let her know of my uneasiness about the Indians, I told her I was trying to sell lots to the men, while they were en route. As the night wore on, and everything seemed quiet, I prepared to get a little rest. I did not take my clothes off, and, much to my wife's surprise, slept with my rifle and revolvers close by me. I had just dropped off to sleep when I heard shots, and knew they could mean nothing but Indians. The attacking party was small and we were fully prepared. When they discovered this, they fired a few shots and galloped away. The second night was almost a repetition of the first. After another party had been repulsed, Mrs. Cody asked me if I had brought her and the baby out on the plains to be killed. This is the kind of a life I lead every day and get fat on it, I said. But she did not seem to think it especially congenial. Everybody turned out to greet us when we arrived in Rome. Even the gambling hall houses and the dance halls closed in our honor. The next day we moved into our little house. That night there was a veritable fusillade of revolver shots outside the window. What is that? Asked Mrs. Cody. Just a serenade, I said. Are you on firing blank cartridges? No. If it became known that revolvers were loaded with blank cartridges around here, we would soon lose some of our most valued citizens. Everybody in town, from the police judge to dishwashers, carries a pistol. Why? To keep law and order. That puzzled my wife. She said that in St. Louis policemen kept law and order, and wanted to know why we didn't have them to do it out here. I informed her that a policeman would not last very long in a town like this, which was perfectly true. On my return from a hunting trip a few days later, I met a man who had come into town on the stagecoach, and whom Mrs. Cody had seen looking over the town site from every possible angle. He told me he thought I had selected a good town site, and I agreed with him. He asked me to go for a ride around the surrounding country with him the next day. I told him I was going on a buffalo hunt. He had never killed a buffalo, he said. He wanted to get a fine head to take back with him, and would be grateful if I would take him with me. I promised to see that he got a nice head if he came along, and early the next morning rode down to his hotel. He was dressed in a smart hunting costume and had his rifle. We started for the plains, my wagons following to gather up the meat we should kill. As we rode out, I explained to him how I hunted. I kill as many buffalo as I want, I said. This I call a run. The wagons come along afterward, and the butchers cut the meat and load it. When I went out on my run, I told him where to shoot to kill. But when my work was done, I met him coming back crestfallen. He had failed to get his buffalo down, although he had shot him 3 times. Come along with me, I said. I see another herd over there. I'm going to change saddles with you, and let you ride the best buffalo horse on the plains. He was astonished and delighted to think I would let him ride Brigham, the most famous buffalo horse in the West. When we drew near the herd, I pointed out a fine 4-year-old bull with a splendid head. I galloped alongside. Brigham spotted the buffalo I wanted, and after my companion's 3rd shot, the brute fell. My pupil was overjoyed with his success, and appeared to be so grateful to me, that I felt sure I should be able to sell him 3 or 4 blocks of Rome real estate at least. I invited him to take dinner, and served as part of the repast the meat of the buffalo he had shot. The next morning he looked me up, and told me he wanted to make a proposition to me. What is it? I asked. I had thought I was the one who was going to make a proposition. I will give you 1/8 of this town site, he said. The nerve of this proposal took me off my feet. Here was a total stranger offering me 1/8 of my own town site, as a reward for what I had done for him. I told him that if he killed another buffalo, I would have to hog-hobble him and send him out of town, then rode off and left him. This magnanimous offer occurred right in front of my own house. My wife overheard it, and also my reply. As I rode away, he called out that he wanted to explain, but I was thoroughly disgusted. I have no time to listen to you, I shouted over my shoulder. I was bound out on a buffalo hunt to get meat for the graders 20 miles away on the railroad, and I kept right on going. 3 days afterward, I rode back over the ridge above the town of Rome and looked down on it. I took several more looks. The town was being torn down and carted away. The balloon frame buildings were coming apart section by section. I could see at least 100 teams and wagons carting lumber, furniture, and everything that made up the town over the prairies to the eastward. My pupil at buffalo hunting was Dr. Webb, president of the Town Site Company of the Kansas Pacific. After I had ridden away without listening to his explanations, he had invited the citizens of Rome to come over and see where the new railroad division town of Hays City was to be built. He supplied them with wagons for the journey from a number of rock wagons that had been lent him by the government, to assist him in the location of a new town. The distance was only a mile, and he got a crowd. At the town site of Hayes City he made a speech, telling the people who he was and what he proposed to do. He said the railroad would build its repair shops at the new town, and there would be employment for many men, and that Hayes City was destined soon to be the most important place on the plains. He had already put surveyors to work on the site. Lots, he said, were then on the market, and could be had far more reasonably than the lots in Rome. My fellow citizens straightway began to pick out their lots in the new town. Webb loaned them the 6 mule government wagons, to bring over their goods and chattels, together with the timbers of their houses. When I galloped into Rome, that day there was hardly a house left standing save my little home, our general store, and a few sod houses and dugouts. Mrs. Cody and the baby were sitting on a dry goods box, when I rode up to the store. My partner, Rose, stood nearby, whistling and whittling. My word, Rose. What has become of our town? I cried. Rose could make no answer. Mrs. Cody said, you wrote me you was worth $250,000. We've got no time to talk about that now, I said. What made this town move away? You ought to have taken Mr. Webb's offer, was her answer. Who the dickens is Webb? I stormed. Rose looked up from his whittling. Bill, he said, that little flapper Jack was the president of the town site company for the KP Railroad, and he's run such a bluff on our citizens about a new town site that is going to be a division point, that they've all moved over there. Yes, commented Mrs. Cody, and where is your $250,000? Well, I've got to make it yet, I said, and then to Rose, how did the fall hit you? What fall? From millionaire to pauper. It hasn't got through hitting me yet, he said solemnly. Rose went back to his grading contract, and I resumed my work as a buffalo hunter. When the Perry House, the Rome Hotel, was moved to Hayes City and rebuilt there, I took my wife and daughter and installed them there. It was hard to descend from the rank of millionaires to that of graders and buffalo hunters, but we had to do it. The rise and fall of modern Rome had made us, and it broke us.